We now present Mr. Wolcott.
This page will be devoted to the work, the oral work, of the late Sir James Barrie, the little Scottish writer who was the author of The Little Minister. That he was the master of the spoken word, everyone knew who had seen such plays as Peter Pan and What Every Woman Knows. But that he himself could speak words tellingly, no one knew, not even Barrie himself, until a May day in 1922 when, by that time a crusty baronet full of years, an almost legendary figure, as cherished and sacrosanct an item in the British possessions as Magna Carta or the Kohinoor Diamond, Sir James was invited to make the rectorial address at St. Andrews University. From that address, known now in every library under the title Courage, let me give you one passage. I should like to read you some passages of a letter from a man of another calling, which I think will hearten you. I have the little filmy sheet here. I thought you might like to see the actual letter. It has been a long journey. It has been to the South Pole. It is a letter to me from Captain Scott of the Antarctic, and was written in the tent you know of, where it was found long afterwards with his body and those of some other very gallant gentlemen, his comrades. The writing is in pencil, still quite clear, though toward the end some of the words trail away as into the great silence that was waiting for them. It begins, "We are pegging out in a very comfortless spot, hoping this letter may be found and sent to you. I write you a word of farewell. I want you to think well of me and my end. After some private instructions to Winterman to read," he goes on, "goodbye. I am not at all afraid of the end, but sad to miss many a simple pleasure which I had planned for the future in our long marches. We are in a desperate state, feet frozen and so forth, no fuel, and a long way from food. But it would do your heart good to be in our tent, to hear our songs and our cheery conversation. Later, it is here that the words become difficult. We are very near the end. We did intend to finish ourselves when things proved like this, but we have decided to die naturally without. I think it may uplift you all to stand for a moment by that tent and listen, as he says, to their songs and cheery conversation. When I think of Scott, I remember the strange Alpine story of the youth who fell down a glacier and was lost, and of how a scientific companion, one of several who accompanied him, all young, computed that the body would again appear at a certain date and place many years afterwards. When that time came around, some of the survivors returned to the glacier to see if the prediction would be fulfilled. All old men now, and the body reappeared as young as on the day he left them. So Scott and his comrades emerge out of the white immensity, always young. How comely a thing is affliction borne cheerfully, which is not beyond the reach of the humblest of us. What is beauty? It is these hard-bitten men singing courage to you from their tent. It is the ways of their island home, pruning of their deeds to you who are to follow them. Sometimes, beauty boils over, and then spirits are abroad. Ages may pass as we look or listen, for time is annihilated. There's a very old legend told to me by Nansen the explorer. I like well to be in the company of explorers. The legend of a monk who had wandered into the fields and a lark began to sing. He'd never heard a lark before, and he stood there entranced until the bird and its song had become part of the heavens. Then he went back to the monastery and found there a doorkeeper whom he did not know and who did not know him. Other monks came, and they were all strangers to him. He told them he was Father Anselm, but that was no help. Finally, they looked through the books of the monastery, and these revealed that there had been a Father Anselm there 100 or more years before. Time had been blotted out while he listened to the lark. That, I suppose, was a case of beauty boiling over, or a soul boiling over, perhaps the same thing. Then spirits walk. Thus to James Barry that day at St. Andrews. In the hushed audience, Galsworthy was there, and Ellen Terry, and Field Marshal Haig. There must have been some who knew by rumor and more who guessed that that last letter written by Scott was sent to the good friend who had backed his expedition. And if you ever read Margaret Ogilvy, Barry's Life of His Mother, you know that he loved Nansen and financed Scott because she would have wished him to. She, who liked the explorers to be alive so that she could shudder at the thought of their venturing forth again, but though she expressed a hope that they would have the sense to stay at home henceforth, she gleamed with admiration when they disappointed her. On that day when such a one would return victorious, she grudged him to his mother. Then, what was before her eyes was not the son come marching home again, but an old woman peering for him around the window curtain and trying not to look uplifted. The newspaper report would be about the son, but a Margaret Ogilvy's comment was, "She's a proud woman this night." At St. Andrews, Barry spoke of his rectorial address as his first and last public appearance, but that day he tasted blood, and after that there was no stopping him. Let me give now the speech he made some 8 or 10 years later at a dinner in London before a group of people who were expected to contribute to the hospital for children in Great Ormond Street, that hospital which for many years has owned and every year profits enormously by the play called Peter Pan. Here is the speech. It was made at the Guildhall. I notice that I am being called the chairman this evening. If you don't mind, I should prefer to follow the old custom and be called the chair. I feel that children would be more interested in me if they thought I was the chair. Children, you know, the marvel of the world to me is that you can pick out your own. You really think when you take them to a party that it is always the same one you bring back? It should now be evident to you that I am the chair tonight owing to an extraordinary blunder made by the hospital. I can't abide children, never could. It was merely pretend on my part to get round their mothers and so spend an idle hour in dallying. I know a boy of 4 who, when he wakes up and sees his son, calls out, "Good morning, God," his own idea. Horrible. I saw the eclipse of 2 or 3 years ago. There were hundreds of thousands of us on a Yorkshire hill, reverent, appalled. But there was also, of course, the inevitable child. What was he doing in the one thrilling moment of his life? He was trying to catch earwigs in the part of a soap dish that has holes in it. It is said that mothers like best the children who give the most trouble. I suppose Cain was Eve's favorite. Wordsworth says, "The children arrive trailing clouds of glory." I question this. It is so, it is probably the very worst ones who come that way. Mind you, I don't blame them. It is everyone for himself in this world, and no one knows that better than a child. Be thankful that you have me to protect you tonight, for they are to make a fierce assault upon your already depleted pocket. This assault will be conducted by unprincipled representatives whom they hoodwinked long ago. The rules compel me to ask those suspects to address you. But before doing so, I feel that it is my duty to warn you against them. Perhaps the most sinister figure in the Guildhall tonight is Lord Macmillan. Attuned by his calling to make the worst appear the better reason, he'll stick at nothing in his championship of the Children's Hospital. One of the most artful things he's likely to do this evening is to invite you to come to that hospital and judge for yourselves. That sounds fair, but don't you do it. If you do that, he's got you. It would be impossible for any bigley, which is what children call you, to go round those wards without writing in a wobbly, which is what they call your checkbook, or producing a crinkly, which is their name for a fiver. While Lord Macmillan is getting at you, you hold my hand and I'll pull you through. Those patients in the hospital bed, I don't know whether they're following the instructions of Lord Macmillan or whether it is just their own natural depravity, or whether in some moment of aberration I have put them up to it myself, But small as they are, as soon as you enter, they will immediately look smaller. You may take it from me that this is a deliberate design to melt you. They know that there is a degree of smallness a sick child can reach which is beyond putting up with. There they are, lying broken in their cots, making the most of their illness, their bandages, their shrunken forms, the girls listless with dolls beside them neglected, as if they needed someone to teach them what a child does with a doll. Don't let go my hand. They're just playing a game with your long faces. They are so happy in those cozy beds that soon they burst into merriment because you're pitying them. And they hug their dolls as if they knew all about them. And they dive beneath their blankets and kick with joy and peep at you mischievously over the coverlet. All because they are the lucky ones who have cots in the hospital for sick children in Great Ormond Street. Now perhaps is the time for you to cut and run. Don't look out at the windows, or you may see some emaciated little face staring up at them wistfully. He is carrying a tiny bundle, containing, I suppose, his night thing. But he can't get in because we are already far too full. He and his like are a sadder sight than you will find inside the hospital. The little fools think it's a sort of heaven. Don't ask Lord Macmillan for statistics. He might show you some child who had been carried in a few weeks before, fevered, done for, and is now going out romping with her exultant parents. He might tell you, and it would be the truth, that this is a sight which has been witnessed a million times or so since our hospital was opened. A million children saved. It is something to set against even the ravages of the war. We have now pulverized Lord Macmillan. But instead of throwing up his brief, he calls as witness no less a person than Mr. Justice Eve. You see from the program that Mr. Justice Eve is to speak about medical and nursing staff, and I know he will have such fine things to say of them that I'm rather alarmed. I fear that when his turn comes, it won't be any good your holding my hand. At this moment, I merely ask him to say yes or no to two or three questions. Kindly conceive Mr. Justice Eve stepping into the witness box and looking around him curiously as if he had gone into the wrong compartment. Now, sir, I say sharply to him, do you dare to stand there and tell me that much of the work of the medical staff of this hospital, nobly helped by famous physicians and surgeons from outside, consists of investigations into the causes of children's ailments, which are thus in time modified or even banished from the world? His damping answer is yes. Take care, witness. Because of their devotion to, do these eminent physicians give up all the accommodation that is rightly theirs to the children and carry on their researches in the very holes and corners of the hospital? Yes, again. One question about the nurses. Are the nurses sacrificing themselves? Are they in order to save a few more children living in such discomfort that it is a shame to every one of us who lives in comfort? Yes, if he is compelled to answer that question. I say hurriedly, no. But Lord Macmillan says hurriedly, yes. Things are not going too well with me now, and I'd better let go your hand. I can do no more for you. Yes, I can. I've seen enough of our medical and nursing staff to know that however hard-heartedly we refuse our succor, they will disregard their own worldly interests and go on fighting for the children. So let us take advantage of that devotion and sneak out of doing our part. The hospital will still go on, because they will never forsake it. For so long, so great, our hospital will have, of course, to fall gradually from the front rank, but it will continue to shine from Great Ormond Street, beckoning to that emaciated little face carrying a bundle who is still staring up wistfully at the windows. Perhaps the bundle does not contain his night thing. Perhaps he has no night thing. It would be funny, wouldn't it, if the bundle turned out too late to be full of trailing clouds of glory. Well, the light from Great Ormond Street will still burn, but it may have in the future to be a smaller light instead of the glowing beacon it could become if you and yours and others like you would say it shall. Once upon a time, at the behest of the younger Theodore Roosevelt, I used the radio to persuade many thousands of my neighbors to look into their little desk drawers and send him the poems they had liked well enough to cut out and tuck away there. Out of these, he selected and published the book of verse called The Desk Drawer Anthology. On this last page, I should like to record some of the verses you might find if you looked in my desk drawer. Let me begin with one which millions have heard of and few have read. If at this moment, instead of recording this page, I were broadcasting from coast to coast, and if, by chance, 5 million people were listening to me, I think it's safe to say that 4 million of them would recognize as something long familiar the first line of this poem. But only a few hundred thousand would ever have read the poem itself. And only 10,000 could tell you who wrote it. It was written a century ago by a woman named Mary Howitt. Listen. "Will you walk into my parlor?" said the spider to the fly. "'Tis the prettiest little parlor that ever you did spy. The way into my parlor is up a winding stair, and I have many curious things to show when you are there." "Oh, no, no," said the little fly. "To ask me is in vain. For who goes up your winding stair can ne'er come down again. I'm sure you must be weary, dear, with soaring up so high. Will you rest upon my little bed?" said the spider to the fly. "There are pretty curtains drawn around. The sheets are fine and thin, and if you like to rest a while, I'll snugly tuck you in." "Oh, no, no," said the little fly, "for I've often heard it said, they never, never wake again who sleep upon your bed." Said the cunning spider to the fly, "Dear friend, what can I do to prove the warm affection I've always felt for you? I have within my pantry good store of all that's nice. I'm sure you're very welcome. Would you please to take a slice?" "Oh, no, no," said the little fly. "Kind sir, that cannot be. I've heard what's in your pantry, and I do not wish to see." "Sweet creature," said the spider, "you're witty and you're wise. How handsome are your gauzy wings, how brilliant are your eyes. I have a little looking glass upon my parlor shelf. If you'll step in one moment, dear, you shall behold yourself." "I thank you, gentle sir," she said, "for what you're pleased to say, and bidding you good morning now, I'll call another day." The spider turned him round about and went into his den, for well he knew the silly fly would soon be back again. So he wove a supple web in a little corner sly, and set his table ready to dine upon the fly. Then he came out to his door again and merrily did sing, "Come hither, hither, pretty fly, with the pearl and silver wing. Your robes are green and purple. There's a crest upon your head. Your eyes are like the diamond bright, but mine are dull as lead. Alas, alas, how very soon this silly little fly, hearing his wily flattering words, came by. With buzzing wings she hung aloft and nearer and nearer drew, thinking only of her brilliant eyes and green and purple hue, thinking only of her crested head, poor foolish thing." At last, up jumped the cunning spider and fiercely held her fast. He dragged her up his winding stair into his dismal den within his little parlor. But she ne'er came out again. And now, dear little children, who may this story read? To idle, silly, flattering words I pray you ne'er give heed. Unto an evil counselor, friend I, and take a lesson from this tale of the spider and the fly. Now I'll read you the poem called Death and General Putnam by Arthur Guiterman. Death and General Putnam. His iron arm had spent its force. No longer might he rein a horse. Lone beside the dying blaze, dreaming dreams of younger days, sat old Israel Putnam. Twice he heard, then three times more, a knock upon the open door. A knock he could not fail to know, that old man in the ember glow. "Come," said General Putnam. The door swung wide. In cloak and hood, lean and tall, the pilgrim stood and spoke in tones none else might hear. "Once more I come to bring you fear." "Fear," said General Putnam. "You know not fear, and yet this face your eyes have seen in many a place since first in Stony Pumphreth when you dragged the mad wolf from her den." "Yes," said General Putnam. "Was I not close when, stripped and bound, with blazing faggots heaped around, you heard the Huron war cry shrill? Was I not close at Bunker Hill?" "Close," said General Putnam. "Am I not that which strong men dread on stricken field or fevered bed, on gloomy trail and stormy sea? And dare you name my name to me?" "Death," said General Putnam. "We have been comrades, you and I, in chase and war beneath the sky, and now, whatever fate may send, old comrade, can you call me friend?" "Friend," said General Putnam. Then up he rose and forth they went, away from battleground, fortress, tent, mountain, wilderness, field, and farm. Death and the general, arm in arm. Death and General Putnam. And next, I'll read from the book called 2nd April by Edna St. Vincent Millay. I'll read the poem she calls Lament. Here it is. "Listen, children, your father is dead. From his old coats, I'll make you little jackets. I'll make you little trousers from his old pants. There'll be in his pocket things he used to put there, keys and pennies covered with tobacco. Dan shall have the pennies to save in his bank. Ann shall have the keys to make a pretty noise with. Life must go on, and the dead be forgotten. Life must go on, though good men die. Ann, eat your breakfast. Dan, take your medicine. Life must go on. I forget just why." And next, let me read you a nameless poem written by a professor of Latin at Cambridge University in England. This is number 18 in the volume called Last Poem by the late A.E. Houseman. The rain it streams on stone and hillock, the boot clings to the clay. Since all is done that's due and right, let's home. And now, my lass, good night, for I must turn away. Good night, my lad, for naught's eternal. No league of ours, for sure. Tomorrow I shall miss you less, and ache of heart and heaviness are things that time should cure. Over the hill the highway marches, and what's beyond is wide. Oh, soon enough will pine to naught remembrance and the faithful thought that sits the grave beside. The skies, they are not always rainy, nor gray the 12 months through. And I shall meet good days and mirth, and range the lovely lands of earth with friends no worse than you. But, oh, my man, the house is fallen that none can build again. My man, how full of joy and woe your mother bore you years ago. Tonight,